Titanic Talk with Nelson Aspin and Alexandra Boyd. Here we feature stories from the independent documentary Ship of Dreams Titanic Movie Diaries and everything else to do with the iconic ship. From James Cameron's epic groundbreaking movie to the history and legacy of Titanic herself. Join us and our special guests as we continue the 25th anniversary celebrations of Titanic. This is your first class ticket to everything aboard the Ship of Dreams.
I'm Nelson Aspin, and this is Titanic Talk. And of course, my lovely co-host, Alexandra Boyd, is the filmmaker behind the documentary Ship of Dreams, Titanic Movie Diaries. And our guest today is someone who's a part of the Ship of Dreams family, thanks to his masterful work. And like so many of us that not only participate in this podcast, but listen in as well, we are passionate with our love for Titanic, and more people are taking that passion and turning it into professional endeavors as well. And that's what's so exciting for us today to talk to our special guest. Alexandra, will you do the honors?
I will. I want to introduce James Penker, who came to me when I was looking for an image of the carpet in the first class dining room. And you know, you Google, and some images come up, and one of the first images was Titanic Honor and Glory, and there was this name there. I immediately sent this very polite, "Do you think it would be possible?" And I think, James, tell me, you called me and you hadn't even got halfway through our trailer. Tell me a little bit about what that was like. And then I want to talk to you about Titanic Honor and Glory, because many people listening will already know, but there's a whole world out there who won't know. So what happened when you got this random email from me going, can I use some of your images?
Yes. So, well, first of all, thanks for having me. And I must clarify, when you say masterful work from Titanic Honor and Glory, I have nothing to do with how beautiful the ship looks and how beautiful the recreations are. I am a spokesperson, but I have to give all the credit in the world to the rest of the team who make the visuals. But yes, one of my jobs is I answer our emails. I'm just our general contact person. I speak publicly about our projects. And so I got your email. And yeah, I got halfway through the trailer and was already, Yes. I obviously the movie was a big part of my childhood and a big reason why I am as into Titanic as I am. It was my introduction to Titanic as a 6-year old. But as an actor myself, I've played small parts, I've played big parts. I know the struggles. I know it all. I think what struck me most, though, was I was seeing the faces of people that I feel like I knew. Your face, other faces from the movie that I've seen the movie so many times, and it's such a big part of my life to see these people today talking about their experiences. I literally felt like I was seeing like old relatives in a way, and I just thought, this is the greatest idea. Whatever you need, we are happy to provide. And everyone on our team felt the exact same way. When I showed them the trailer, they were like, oh my God, that's this person. Yes, whatever. Like we want our stuff to be in there. So
for folks who don't know, James, tell us about the company.
Sure. So the company overall is called Vintage Digital Revival, VDR for short. We make Titanic recreations in a virtual world. So we have many different Titanic recreations being developed at the moment. They range from real-time sinkings, one of which went viral many years ago. It's about to top 90 million views on YouTube. We just released a brand new real-time sinking just 10 days ago for the anniversary. So we make sinkings of Titanic so you can see and witness her final moments in real time with
and feel it. I will argue that you feel it as
you really do
as you watch it. It's visceral.
There's something really powerful about it. Of course, we can talk about James Cameron and his filmmaking ability and those right. quick cut edits and the music, and that's what movies do. But when you watch these real time moments, it's so real. It gives you, it's mesmerizing watching it moment by moment without any music, with just a little bit of sound effect. I mean, it's really quite effective.
It gives you a completely new perspective. I highly recommend to anybody who loves Titanic, you should sit down and watch a real time sinking. I believe that ours are the best, so I would recommend reading or watching ours. But I often compare it to people who consider themselves Beatles fans and they know all the hits. You gotta listen to the whole catalog. Like that's how you really appreciate the hits. You'll find if you watch our most recent Real Time Sinking, there's a lot of shout outs to James Cameron's film and other famous Titanic imagery like Ken Marshall's paintings. So you get those moments that you're familiar with, you know, a shot where the camera runs with the ship at quite an angle as the camera slides up. We have those moments, but you also get all the sort of fly on the wall moments. You know, not every moment of the sinking is particularly exciting. And that is part of the reason why so many people stayed on the ship, because nothing was really happening. Nothing was really dramatic early on. In fact, if you really dive into survivor testimony, you'll be shocked to see how late in the sinking a crewman who should know better, would leave the ship less than an hour before it will be gone forever. And in their own words, they didn't think anything was wrong. So, you know, the movie, if anything, the excitement gets going a little too quick. So if you watch it in real time, you really see how safe it seemed all the way to the end. So we do those
especially compared sinkings. To the lifeboats, how precarious the lifeboats
yes,
seemed
exactly,
just to get
exactly.
into one.
Right. So we make these real-time sinkings. That's one of the things that sort of put us on the map in a way. But our main focus are, we have two other Titanic recreations. We also have like imagery that appears in documentaries and in museums and such. So we just, in general, we make Titanic visuals. But our two main projects are Titanic Project 401 and Titanic Honor and Glory, which are aiming to recreate in Titanic Honor and Glory's case, 100% of Titanic from top to bottom in the most glorious detail you could possibly imagine. So you can put on a VR headset and look up at the Grand Staircase Dome. So you can be in the engine room and watch the engines, you know, revolve in front of you. We want to recreate as much of Titanic as possible to create the most incredible Titanic museum-like interactive setting that you could possibly imagine.
Where, like, there are so many iconic places on the ship. Mm-hmm. For you as a Titaniac, where are your favorite places to visit on the ship?
Yeah, well, it's great because we do have, you know, Project 401, which is sort of our most further along project, which is currently a demo 401, we call it. It's available for free on our website right now if you have a computer that can process a hefty video game. This is not for an iPad. This is not for an Android phone. We get that question a lot. It is for a true gaming computer, but you can explore up to 50% of Titanic for free. And I like to just wander around, but the spaces I always go back to in terms of first class, the reading and writing room. It is such a beautiful space. It does not appear in the film at all. Most first class spaces do appear in some way. The lounge is in there, the restaurant or the veranda cafe is in there. You know, there a lot of it is, but the reading and writing room is not, because nothing really important happened there. In fact, on Titanic's actual voyage, it was found that the reading and writing room was being underused. It was designed to be the female counterpart to the smoke room. And it just wasn't being used. And in fact, on Olympic, it would be shrunk to be smaller because just no one was going in there. So they took half of it and made it into a stateroom to just have one more stateroom. But my favorite space on the entire ship is the second class smoke room. I just love the interiors. The interiors, the green leather chairs, the tile. It's the first class smoke room is very opulent and a little too opulent for modern tastes. But the second class smoke room is right in the sweet spot where I think modern people would feel this is very rich. This is very country club whiskey tasting kind of. It's just in the and during the day, the sunlight just comes right in. While in the first class smoke room, it's stained glass windows, so there's never like a lot of light in the first class smoke room. So second class smoke room wins the argument for me.
I love to hear you talking about the light, because that is one of the extraordinary things that these digital recreations are able to do, is that you feel, you know, when it's one of my favorite moments, I can't even call them shots, one of the moments when we were going through all of the clips that you sent us are the nighttime ones where, you know, the sky is very dark, but all of the lights from inside the ship. And then we do like a little tour around, little drone shot, or I call it a seagull's eye view. And you come around and it's just so breathtaking. And also, when we did our press screening back in January, and I know you and some of your team were able to watch then, Nelson moderated, as you know, and we were setting everything up and we used a loop of that seagull's eye scan as our wallpaper while we were waiting to bring everybody in. And I will never forget Nelson. We put up the ship and he goes, "Oh, there she is." Like, he got really emotional, Nelson, when somebody who would come to this, I don't want to call it, it's not a computer game. What is it? It's a virtual reality.
I'm glad you said that, actually, because while this project began over a decade ago as a video game, the intention was to make a video game with a story mode. There was going to be like a murder on the ship and you had to solve it, you know, that kind of thing. Because a big thing that inspired us to do this was a 1996 video game called Titanic Adventure Out of Time, where there was, it was like a international espionage kind of, you were a member of the Secret Service back on Titanic. It was very dramatic and fun. We have sort of abandoned that idea for a million reasons, but the short answer is just that a modern video game is probably one of the hardest art forms to achieve with a small independent team. You need 500 employees, hundreds of millions of dollars to make a game like that. And then also the gamification of a disaster has always sat funny for some people, myself especially. I didn't know what we were going to do when the ship started to sink. Would we recreate people running for their lives and screaming? It was hard to process. So right now, we don't really consider the game a video game, and I even just said game, but they are historical recreations. They are virtual museums. They are studies of Titanic's construction. They're really so much more than a video game.
And what I find fascinating is, in addition to your artistic work there, you take your artistic work on the road as a performer. You have been in Titanic, the musical.
Yes, I have.
You are ready to set sail, as we are recording this, for a cruise gig. Tell us about how you have taken your recreational passion for Titanic and beyond the video world, turned it into your life. I mean, you're kind of living a Titanic life. And how does your partner feel about all of this?
Oh, sure. That's great. I wish she was here to tell you all about it. I was always one of, you know, like many people watching this, probably Titanic nerd, Titaniac, whatever you want to call the Titanic nuts out there. I was one of them, and I never grew out of it. And I just always loved Titanic. And it was actually Titanic, the musical, the 1997 Broadway musical. A local theater was doing it, and I got a part in it because I was an actor by that point in high school.
Who'd you play?
In that first production, I played Second Officer Charles Lighthaller. But I told the director, look, I love Titanic and I know a lot about it, from my childhood. I'd love if you have any questions. And so suddenly my love of Titanic was useful to an adult, you know, somebody. I wasn't just being an obsessed kid. I was being very helpful. And I, I served as the historian for that production, and I've done it many times since. I've performed in it two other times, both as Thomas Andrews, which is a dream. One of the productions was on the 100th anniversary of the sinking. It was with a symphony orchestra. It was the most beautiful thing you could imagine. It was a wonderful production. But so I've used my Titanic historian side on a more practical level since I've become an adult. And so I serve as consultant on things, but on the cruise ship that we leave on Monday, we go to sea for 5 months. And when I'm on the cruise ship, one of the things that I do, along with I'm a guitarist, a musician, I'm living with other actors, we're rehearsing a show, we're doing a whole show. But one of the things that I also do is I give lectures on Titanic on the cruise ship. Usually when we're doing a transatlantic, there's lots of time to kill. So I talk about Titanic for anybody who's willing to join. And
is
while
there a delicate balance there, talking about the Titanic on a cruise ship?
Yes, there is. And the company that I work for, they were apprehensive at first, but I said, trust me, people love this stuff. And sure enough, just every performance lecture, completely sold out. That people, it doesn't matter where they are. I mean, it really hits home when you're at sea and you can tell people Titanic's wreck is in the body of water that we are sailing across. And you can say things like, this ship that we are on is 1,300 feet long. Titanic was almost half that, you know? So really, it gives a better perspective than you would on land.
And also, I thought you were going to say, and also, even though Titanic was dubbed unsinkable, there were many, many safety regulations that came into play because of Titanic. You know, number one being the light, you have to have enough lifeboats and seat for what every bottom.
Well, I tell them all. Yeah, I tell them all, you know, we have to do this drill when you get on the ship. And I know it's annoying, but you have Titanic to thank for that. And you can rest assured. Like I won't go as far to say that the ship we are on is unsinkable, because that is always not true. But there is just so much in place now, and it's all thanks to Titanic, and in part thanks to the 2,200 people who endured the worst night a human can endure. Many, it was their last night, but we have those people and that sort of sacrifice to thank, that we can have a cruise ship be as just safe and lovely as they can be today.
And I must ask about your wife and how she handles your Titanic enthusiasm.
Right.
Or does she have her own? Is Ida to your Isidore?
Oh my gosh, that is hysterical. No, she had seen the movie as a kid, but it was just a movie to her. I waited until our third date to bring it up. You know, and with previous relationships, it was always interesting to decide when is the right moment to tell them about your strange obsession with disaster. And so what I did is I took her to Pier 54 in New York City, where we live, at the time where we lived. And, you know, the pier where Titanic survivors disembarked, it's a very meaningful place to me, because it's the only real landmark we have in the United States for Titanic is this spot. And then I took her there. I showed her why this means so much to me. And she's so lovely. She's been so supportive of all my Titanic-ness. And she's as fascinated as I am sometimes. You know, I'll tell her a story like, oh, you won't believe what I just read, because I still learn things to this day. I'll be in a book and I'll read something and I'll tell her about it, and she'll just be amazed by it. So she really, she's very proud of herself when she goes to a party without me and she's the one telling people about Titanic. So I'm very proud of her in that way.
She's got her own things, I'm sure, but that's for another podcast.
Yeah.
But I think also, though, you're demonstrating how even you can't just have a passing interest once you start to learn the stories. You know, I could say that I really didn't know much about Titanic before I researched the monologue that I had to put together for James Cameron. But once I was into it, you know, even before I stepped on that set, Once I think this is and there are 2,000 human stories, personal stories.
Right.
And you know, we've a couple of the people in my documentary played real people. And you can see how 25 years later, even Peter White, who so sadly was completely cut from the film, you can see he connects very deeply with Third Officer Groves of the California, which is the character.
Right.
Because he, of course, he did all the research for it, for two lines. Because
right.
Because you can't just do it in a passing fashion.
And James, you mentioned playing Thomas Andrews and how much that meant to you. And it's interesting when you speak to Titanic enthusiasts, they do sort of lock in on a particular character, a particular story. Mm-hmm. Is it for you? Is it Thomas Andrews? Is that your guy?
I guess it kind of has to be, probably because being that I played him in the musical a couple times.
And you're kind of an architect of in a way.
I've not thought about it too deeply. I've researched him so much because of that I do know the random details about his life in particular. But I find myself tied to less to the individual people and more like the things that they've said or the stories that they've told. You know, one person saying, you know, just as an example, the Futrells were on Titanic. Jacques Futrell, he was a writer, and his wife May Futrell, she survived, he did not. I don't know if she was a writer in her own right. I haven't researched it that deeply, but she writes very beautifully, and she speaks very beautifully, and it makes sense that she was married to a writer. But her comments about Titanic, I just adore. You know, the things that she says about what it was like to lose her husband, she puts it in just such beautiful language. And so I'm drawn to her and the way she talks about Titanic. Sadly, we will never hear Thomas Andrews talk about Titanic because he did not survive. But so it's kind of an unfair comparison when you're talking about a victim versus survivor. We get to hear what the survivors felt. And so I'm drawn to some of them in that way, I think.
The very opening scene of Ship of Dreams, Titanic Movie Diaries, that's me reading a little bit from my monologue, which I lifted from The Countess of Roth. And she had written her own account, and I was like, well, I ain't rewriting this, I'm using this for my memory.
Yeah, I mean, the language is unbelievable.
And I read it a number of ways for the film, and we ended up just using a voiceover with a beautiful image of the wreck drawn by Dale McCarthy, one of our fans. And when I read that particular segment that she wrote, sometimes I can't get through it. I get choked up just imagining and making a connection to her being triggered by a piece of music that was playing in the first class dining room the night of the disaster. She'll wonder why she gets this chill over her, and the music's playing now today that she's writing, and it takes her right back to that night.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'll paraphrase May Futrell's quote, but I've read it so many times, maybe I'll get it almost correct. She says something along the lines of, in regards to her husband leaving, putting her in a lifeboat and seeing him for what she now believes to be the last time. She said, I knew then the way that only a wife can know, that I had lost the best friend that I would ever have. You know, just like some beautiful way of, or another one she says is, she was amazed by that the goodbye that these men were making so light was probably forever. Just that, the way she puts it, I don't know, I don't know if it's 100 years of language changing that we can romanticize how people spoke back then, but just a beautiful way of putting a terrible, terrible thing.
Well,
there are more
also
than 2,000 stories.
I know there were a lot of, yes, and I know there were a lot of Americans on that ship, but, you know, that's the stiff upper lip comes to mind, you know, Edwardians, and those men could not possibly show any emotion, you know, when that moment in the film when they're putting the little girls onto the boat and he goes, don't worry, there'll be another boat
with
daddy soon. And he knows there won't be, and we all know there won't be. And it's just... It's grace under pressure, isn't it?
Right, and credit to James Cameron, because I believe that that scene you're speaking of, you know, there'll be another boat for the daddies. That scene is based off of a real account of somebody witnessing a father saying goodbye to their children and saying, you know, don't worry, we'll see each other in the morning. I think one father told the family, you'll be back on before breakfast. You know, this is all just a drill. And for a good amount of the sinking, I do believe that the men believed that they thought everything was fine and that they, you know, this is just a drill. But
they were listing and they were going to limp into New York, but there was no way they had it in their mind.
Right.
In fact, again, that's in the film too. Really only Thomas Andrews knows. Then the captain gets it. I believe you'll have your headlines, Mr. Ismay.
Yes.
Sort of three men have that moment, but it's never really communicated to anybody except Rose when, you know, she sees Thomas Andrews for the last time. It's you can understand that people just thought, oh, it doesn't feel that bad.
And it was also an age of chivalry. It was an age of chivalry where that doesn't exist today. You know, you'd have people beating each other to you know, to get to
to
an exit. You know, that just it was a whole different mindset. Yeah, James, what's left on your Titanic bucket list? What do you still have to accomplish?
Personally? I'm very lucky that last year the cruise that I worked for 6 months went from New York City to Halifax, which I've never been to Halifax, and Halifax is where a majority of the recovered victims are buried. And I got to visit one of the cemeteries where I think 115 or so are. That was a pleasure,
moving.
Sort of honor them. Yeah, very moving thing. We then went over to Belfast, where Titanic was built. We went to Cove, which used to be called Queenstown, which is where Titanic last set sail from. We went to Southampton, where the maiden voyage began. And we went to Liverpool, where Titanic's builder's model is and where White Star Line was headquartered. So I've been pretty much everywhere. The missing pieces, I haven't been to Cherbourg, which was the second stop of the crossing of the voyage. And there is a hotel in the UK, the White Swan Hotel. They have a lot of Titanic's sister ship. They have Olympic's lounge interiors. They bought it in the auction when Olympic was scrapped, and their entire ballroom is exactly how Olympic's lounge would have looked, and therefore Titanic's lounge. So it is as close to standing aboard Titanic as you can get, is this hotel. I want to go there.
I've not heard of that. Where is it?
It's in Alnwick.
Oh, Alnwick in Northumberland.
Sure. I don't. It's it's like two. I think it's 2 hours from Edinburgh.
Yes, it's quite far north in England. There's also a beautiful garden there. Beautiful gardens. So there's it's very beautiful up there. Yes.
Well, James,
I gotta hit that spot.
You are the living example, and I think Alexandra and I can count ourselves somewhat among this as well, but the whole theory of do what you love and you never work a day in your life, I mean, being able to take our passions for things like the Titanic and make careers out of them and make passion projects, and
we feel very
close to you because of all this, and the fact that you're such an important and gorgeous piece of the documentary as well.
Oh my gosh.
And
when we first put the opening titles music, I said to the composer, I said, I want a roll of drums and then I want to fly through into the grand staircase. And the first time I saw them together, well, actually, I still get chills. I still get chills as we fly down and the titles come up and everything. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, we are so lucky.
Yes. I would kick myself if I don't take a second to acknowledge the people who made those beautiful Please. Visuals. Kyle Hudak and Matt DeWinkler, they are sort of the heads of our project. They're the backbone of all those visuals. We have a bunch of incredible modelers who work under them, but they sort of run that whole development process. Derek Revere is our programmer who redid all the lighting so it would look as spectacular as it looks for your documentary. And then Jack Gibson is the gentleman who captured all of it. He's the person I said, look, this is what they want. I think we should have the shot come through this and go up here and go down this and all that. And then he sends me what we collectively have asked for. And he on every occasion sends even better versions of what we asked for, you know? So I come up with ideas. I provide direction. The vision for the projects are mine. But the work that you all will enjoy in the documentary is all of those names and so many more.
I totally understand that too, that the idea that you're the general steering the army, it's like directing anything. You know, people say to me, how did you know how to make a film? I was like, well, you know, it's not all me. You know, I have right. some ideas and I have direction, or I might have written the script. But, you know, to borrow upon and utilize other people's incredible skills and talents, especially in the way that you have, just watch my documentary for that alone. And then, yeah. you know, because we use it as little chapter buffers. We use, you know, an image of the ship, and people will look over at me and go, where did you find that? Where did you get that from? And of course, we couldn't use lots and lots of the film itself because, you know, there's copyright and all that sort of thing.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
And we used a lot of the drawings, which the animated drawings, which I mentioned before, which sort of emulate Jack's sketches
yes.
and drawings. So
amazing,
that,
yeah.
And then to find Titanic Honor and Glory and have it fit perfectly is really just a joy. And one of the wonderful things I love about being a director, when I was an actress, you're sort of at the mercy of the script and the director and the this and that and the other. But when you're the director, you get to make all these decisions and look for and find, if you're really lucky, find these people who can enhance your work and make it so much greater than the sum of its parts.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, the parts that we have are spectacular. I truly feel like I don't I barely even put them together. For me to be here speaking about it, I am the one that does these things because I speak publicly. I'm a trained actor, so I can talk to people and I'm also not as busy as they are working on the ship, but it is 95% all the rest of the team. So
there are no small actors. That is.
Do you have a timeline? Yeah. Is there a timeline, James? You know, I hear you saying there's this 4.0 or this what?
Yes, 401.
When will
yes.
it be finished, or will it never be finished? Because
right. So Titanic Project 401. It's called 401 because that was Titanic's hull number. Olympic was 400. Titanic was 401. It was the 401st ship built by Harlan and Wolff. But Titanic Project 401, we really hope to release next year if all goes to plan. But you know, we have no definitive date for that. But we are in like sort of the nearing the end of that process, which is lovely. Titanic Honor and Glory is just this ever living and breathing thing. We're recreating Titanic the way Harlan and Wolff used to, piece by piece. It is going to be an ongoing, ever improving study. And to think of it as having a release date or being a video game where we're gonna have a big party and make a bunch of money, we don't really think of it that way. It is an ongoing study of Titanic's construction, but we do hope soon to allow players to begin exploring what we have so far. We just don't have, we have no dates in mind. We're trying to keep the pressure off and just keep making great stuff in the meantime.
Do you know, Nelson, that they have Jack Thayer's suite in there? And
we
I was
do.
I wanted to try and find a way to fold it into your story, but it never quite fit. But they did, they got Jack Thayer's room where he stayed.
We do, C70.
Yeah, suite 70, yes. It's amazing.
Well, I'll have to start Project Suite 70 then. it's one of the greatest thing, James, best of all to us, aside from the artistry of it all, is your fandom and your enthusiasm. And so that makes us all connected, just like you are to everybody that's listening and watching this right now. So thank you again so much for your gifts and your enthusiasm.
And thank you for being a part of that movie, because it changed my life. So.
Oh, smooth sailing. Good luck on the voyage.
Thank you very much.
Bon voyage.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review. And if you'd like to hear more podcasts like this, hit the subscribe button. For information on where you can see Ship of Dreams, Titanic Movie Diaries, go to shipofdreamsfilm.com. Titanic Talk is a production of Ship of Dreams Film Limited.